having heard her voice on the voicemail message, I wouldn't count on it, unfortunately. But we will proceed, and she will have the benefit of being able to see everything that was said and shown to us, which will all be part of the record. And again, we hope we'll see her this afternoon and tomorrow, but that remains to be seen. I would like to welcome everyone to our second Washington, D.C. hearing on the Section 1201 rulemaking. I'm David Carson, the Copyright Office General Counsel. To my left is Rob Kasenick, Assistant General Counsel. To his left is Ben Golant, Assistant General Counsel. And to my right is Chris Weston, an attorney advisor in the Office of the General Counsel. Last Friday, we held hearings in Palo Alto, California, that addressed some of the proposed exemptions to this rulemaking. Yesterday, we began our hearings here in Washington. Today, we'll continue to examine proposed exemptions to the prohibition on circumvention found in Section 1201. This hearing is part of the ongoing triennial rulemaking process mandated by Congress in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Section 1201A1 provides that the Librarian of Congress may exempt certain classes of works from the prohibition against circumvention of technological measures that control access to copyrighted works. Any exemptions last for three-year periods beginning on October 28, 2009, when the current exemptions expire. The purpose of this rulemaking proceeding is to determine whether there are particular classes of works as to which users are or are likely to be adversely affected in their ability to make non-infringing uses of works if they are prohibited from circumventing the technological measures that control access to those works. This rulemaking establishes a record on which the Register's recommendation to the Librarian of Congress is based. After our initial notice of inquiry in this rulemaking published in the Federal Register on October 6th last year, we received 20 comments proposing exemptions to the prohibition on circumvention and 56 responses to those proposed exemptions. They're all available for viewing on our website. In addition to this hearing today, we'll be conducting hearings tomorrow in this same room. The agendas for all the hearings are available on our website, and there are some hard copies of the agenda out in the entrance to this this room. We intend to post the transcripts of all the hearings on our website in a few weeks, as soon as they're available to us. The comments, the responsive comments, the hearing testimony will all form the basis of evidence in this rulemaking, which, after consulting with the Assistant Secretary for Communications and Information from the Department of Commerce, will result in the Register's recommendation to the Librarian of Congress, and the Librarian is to make his determination by October 28th on whether exemptions to the prohibition on circumvention should be instituted during the ensuing three-year period, and if exemptions should issue, to determine what particular classes of works should be exempted from the prohibition on circumvention. The format of this hearing will be divided into two parts. First, the witnesses will present their testimony. This is your chance to make your case to us in person, explaining the facts, the technology, hopefully showing us, to the extent that you can, what the problem is or isn't, and making legal and policy arguments that support your claim that there should or should not be a particular exemption. The statements of the witnesses will be followed by questions from members of our panel up here. The panel may be asking some tough questions of the participants in an effort to define and refine the issues and the evidence presented by both sides. Anyone who draws any conclusions from the fact that a particular question was asked is on dangerous turf, I would suggest. We try sometimes to be provocative just to get your best answers and to test the issues. This is an ongoing proceeding. No decisions whatsoever have been made thus far as to any critical issues in this rulemaking. And in an effort to fully obtain relevant evidence, we reserve the right to ask questions in writing to any of the participants in these proceedings after the close of the hearings. It's something that those of you who have participated in the past know is something we freely avail ourselves, a privilege that we freely avail ourselves of. I've introduced the panel, so just a couple of preliminary notes. As we've learned yesterday, cell phones and BlackBerries interfere with our audio signal. So please do what I did just before I started talking and turn off your BlackBerry or PDA or cell phone while you're in this room. Any of the witnesses who have not given us an electronic copy of the material they are displaying or performing or distributing, please do so. It's important that we have that so that we can review it later, and we want to make this available also as part of our record on our website so the public in general can see what it is that we're looking at ourselves. So with that, let's move on to the testimony. This morning, we're looking at two proposed classes. The first is audiovisual works released on DVD, where circumvention is undertaken solely for purposes of extracting clips for inclusion in non-commercial videos. Rob just tells me we're doing it in the opposite order, but I'll finish reading it anyway, of extracting clips for inclusion in non-commercial videos that do not infringe copyright. Before that, we will hear testimony about another proposal for motion pictures and other audiovisual works in the form of digital versatile discs, that's DVDs, that are not generally available commercially to the public in a DVD form, not protected by content scrambling system. When a documentary filmmaker who is a member of an organization of filmmakers or is enrolled in a film program or film production course at a post-secondary educational institution is accessing material for use in a specific documentary film for which substantial production has commenced, where the material is in the public domain or will be used in compliance with the doctrine of fair use as defined by federal case law and under 17 U.S.C. Section 107. We have a number of panelists. I will introduce them as they speak. And our first panelist, Mr. Morissette, Mr. Quinn, are you both testifying? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the first will be Jim Morissette of Cardam Quinn Educational Films, followed by his colleague Gordon Quinn, also from Cardam Quinn Educational Films.
Is it possible to reverse that order?
Absolutely not.
It might be easier to understand.
Of course. Of course.
Okay, so I should start?
Please.
Okay.
And
thanks.
Speak into the microphone.
Hold the microphone.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So I should know this. I'm Gordon Quinn. Thanks for the opportunity to come and speak today. I've been making documentaries for over 40 years. Our organization, Cardam Quinn Educational Films, makes films that are broadcast nationally on PBS, on NBC, also on cable channels. Our best-known film is probably Hoop Dreams. We also did some recent work as a seven-hour series called The New Americans about immigration. A recent film of ours, Terra Incognita, about stem cell research, just received a Peabody Award. And we have a long history of, we've made over 40 major documentaries, won all kinds of awards, and see ourselves as being very important participants in the culture and of our democracy. We tell human stories about real people in the world and try to put them in a context, historical, economic, social, whatever is appropriate to the story we're telling. I'm here today speaking on behalf of all the commentators who jointly submitted the supplemental comments proposing the exemption for documentary filmmakers. The International Documentary Association, the University Film and Video Association, the National Alliance for Media Arts and Culture, the Independent Feature Project, and Film Independent. These are all organizations that serve the field of documentary filmmakers, and we happen to belong to all of them except Film Independent, which is based in L.A. We are out of Chicago and have been there for 40 years. But most documentary filmmakers belong to one of these organizations, at least. Some of the individual filmmakers are Robert Behar, producer of Made in L.A., Kirby Deck, director of This Film Is Not Yet Rated, Arthur Dong, director of Hollywood Chinese, Jeffrey Levy-Hinte, producer of Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, David Novak, producer of Burning the Future, Coal in America, and Morgan Spurlock, director and star of Supersize Me. The DMCA prohibition on circumvention is burdensome, intimidating, and it's really impeding our use to make fair use and public domain claims and material in our film. The exemption we're looking for is for a limited period of time, and it's for documentary filmmakers who we make the case are relatively educated about what fair use is, and what it is not. It's a narrow exemption, and we're only seeking the bare minimum we need to exercise our fair use rights. It's only for CSS, only for the next 3 years. CSS is the very minimum that we need. It's an important and very narrow class, and we are looking to restore the same fair use rights we have relied on for decades. It's such a narrow class that the benefit of the exemption will vastly outweigh any potential harm to the rights holders. I'm here today with Jim Morissette, the technical director of Cartemquin, who will speak about why various alternative circumventions are not really feasible or are extremely burdensome and really don't provide us with the quality that we need. Jim is, we're a documentary center, and so we work with a group of producers, and so we have a core staff of six people. Having a Jim Morissette with our organization is not the case that most documentary filmmakers face. Jim has an engineering background. He's a very high-level technician. Many of the things that I'll be talking about and or he will be showing you are things that many of the most important documentary filmmakers in the country are working in very small production companies, and they don't even have access to some of the methods that people are proposing, saying, well, you can do this to get around it, you can do that to get around it. It doesn't work that well, and Jim's going to explain why, but in many cases, it causes us a great deal of grief. My colleagues, it causes even a lot more grief, because Jim is able to come to me and say, this is why the broadcaster sent it back, here's how we fix it, you know, this is what we're going to do. They have to go seek and pay somebody to help them get through that piece of the process. Fair use is a critical component of what we do. This is undisputed in the reply comments, so I'm not going to really make, I don't think I have to make the case for fair use. I think we all understand why that's an important part of a free and open society and a democratic society. Particularly in documentary filmmaking, it's a critical part of how we participate in the democratic process. Fair use in documentary filmmaking has a long history, and it's predictable. It's more predictable than many other types of fair use, where there may be a great deal of controversy, like in music and things, where people are saying, well, this is, this isn't, where do you draw the line? The DMCA is really having a burdensome effect on our ability to make fair use. DVD is the default distribution format, at least at the present time, and we anticipate it being so for the next 2 or 3 years. To give you an example of how we use fair use to comment on, criticize, put something in film and television, or something in the culture that we get off of these DVDs, let me give you an example of from one of our films, Refrigerator Mothers. This is a film that was made about the mothers of autistic children from the 50s and 60s who were told by the professionals, by the doctors and the experts, that they caused their child's autism because they didn't love their child. They were cold like a refrigerator. And so it's their story. And as a part of telling that story, we show the hold that Freudian psychology had on the popular culture in the 50s and 60s. And we show that there was a culture of putting a lot of weight on mothers for failing about all kinds of things. And we turn to the popular culture to show this. We show examples from feature films, and these are the ones that we managed to put into our film that we got off of DVDs. We show it by showing magazine articles and things. We edit this all together to make this point that this is how this culture and this belief in this system in the period that we're looking at played out as a consequence in these women's lives. It's a critical part of the film. It's also a very short part of the film. We understand fair use. We never take more than we need. And the amount of fair use material in Refrigerator Mothers is probably less than 5% of the total film, which is an hour-long film. It aired nationally on PBS. I think I tell that. We, of course, are concerned about that part of the DMCA, which says that even if the use that you're putting the material to is legal, breaking the encryption is in of itself not. And that's why we need this exemption. It's extremely difficult to maintain the necessary technical quality for fair use in broadcast or theatrical distribution. Various alternatives are not viable. Tremendous burden and technical expertise, time and expense involved, and Jim is really going to talk more about that. Our proposed exemption provides a solution for that. Comments made in opposition to the proposal exemption have suggested some solutions, some modifications. Instead of enabling fair use rights, these suggestions further burden it. First, licensing as an alternative. Well, fair use, the whole point of fair use is that you don't have to license it. It undermines the purpose of the fair use doctrine. I'm sure you're familiar with the study that the Center for Social Media conducted, Untold Stories, in 2005, exploring the licensing process as an implication. Licensing costs are often outrageously high, are only increasing. Broadcasters are demanding more and more digital distribution rights, but right holders are unwilling to license copies. And I'll just digress for a moment. I was on a panel several years ago, and I was sitting between someone from an archive that was licensing material, and I was, on the other hand, I had the broadcaster. And you have the broadcaster laying out the rights that they expect to get, all of these rights for digital, other medium, pretty much everything in the universe. And I have the archive person on the other side of me saying, well, if that's the license that you want, here's what the costs are going to be. They're going to be incredibly exorbitant. We don't even know what this stuff is worth, and so you can't even have the stuff you're asking for. You're not going to be able to license. I'm sitting in the middle, and I said, look, guys, you've got to get together on this because I can't make a film if that's the case. So that's a little bit of a digression because that's what happens in the licensing world, and that stuff is still not resolved. That's still being battled out. But fair use is not licensing. Rights holders, I can give you an example of a situation where we did not use something that would have been fair use. This was quite a few years ago. This was in 2004. We released a major public television series, The New Americans, on immigration. And there's a Nigerian character. And he talks about the film Coming to America. And he says, we love that movie in Africa. That is our favorite film because it shows the incredible depth of Americans' ignorance about Africa and Africans. And he says, you know, we use that line, it's in the film, and we just wanted to show a little clip from the film. We're going to show 10 seconds, you know, just something where you'd see it's Eddie Murphy, that kind of thing. This was in the period that Untold Stories about how we had really lost the ability to make fair use because of all these threatening letters that had gone to broadcasters. Broadcasters weren't accepting it. It was a very dark time for fair use. And we tried to license it, even though I felt it was clearly a fair use claim, and we were not able to get the license. We were very persistent. We went up the line and just kept absolutely not. They weren't going to give it to us in any way, shape, or form. And so we didn't use it, and the film was weaker because of it. In fact, standard provisions in studio licensing contracts prohibit criticism of the studio, the industry, the executives, the characters on or the film. And let me show you. Maybe we just look at this slide for a second. Here is something from an actual licensing contract. It's something that I probably have signed, but I probably shouldn't have in the past over the years. Licensee represents, warrants, and agrees that the production in which the clip is used shall not be derogatory or critical of the entertainment industry or licensor or of any officer, director, agent, employee, affiliate, parent, or subsidiary of a licensor or any motion picture proceeded or distributed by the licensor or any characters owned or controlled by the licensor and will not be used in a manner or a derogatory or critical of the motion picture. For when, anyway, you get the idea. I mean, you know, this is kind of off the chart, particularly if you're talking about fair use, because the heart of fair use is that we have to be able to criticize, to comment on, to put things in context. And so licensing is simply not a solution to the problem documentary producers are facing with fair use, which is not to say that we don't license things all the time, because our view of fair use is very prescribed and very narrow, and when it's not fair use, our broadcasters expect, and we as professionals believe, that of course we're going to license it. We only use fair use when it's appropriate. Fair use is in the copyright law because you cannot use ownership to prevent free expression. So that's my feelings about going down that path. There is also a suggestion that documentary filmmakers be required to ask permission or make a good faith effort to obtain an unencrypted copy of the material from the copyright holders. This has some of the same problems. I don't know how this would play out, but the problem is that these are the very people that we've had all these problems with over all these years. It reads a permission requirement into fair use, and the lawyers are saying, I kind of say this wrong, but I mean, I view fair use as a right. It's like it's something that we need as documentary filmmakers, as storytellers, within these very prescribed guidelines to be able to participate in the culture of the community, to critique things in our society. It's something that I shouldn't have to ask permission for. It can lead us on, it could lead us on wild goose chases. If we feel it's fair use, we still sometimes do go to the artists, but we shouldn't be required to do so. I have many situations in which I've gone directly to an artist. We're using something in fair use. I want them to know it. We acknowledge it. We, of course, want to acknowledge that, you know, we're using something, and we put that on our films. But it shouldn't be a requirement, and it doesn't solve this problem with how do you get your hands on the material. That can also create requirements to pay lab fees. And again, this is where things can get a little bit strange. You can get into a situation where you have the DVD, you have the material, you know what it is, and yet, when you go and say, okay, well, you know, could we get this in this and this form, or could we get it unencrypted, all of a sudden somebody's telling you, oh, yes, but we're going to have to go back to the negative, we're going to have to redigitize it, it's going to be, you know, cost a lot of money. The other thing is that in our work, and particularly in some other documentaries work, which is also very professional and I highly respect, there are a lot of clips used from a lot of different things. They're very short. So you're putting together a montage of a whole bunch of stuff, creating a new kind of thing to sort of show the culture of the times or show how people have been treated in certain kinds of media and that kind of thing. And so you're using lots and lots of different pieces. If each one has to go through a laboratory process and stuff, it's going to add up to a lot of money. There was one other suggestion to modify the proposed class by adding the word solely to the class that would be restricted to accessing material solely for use in the specific documentary film. We don't object to this change. The Copyright Office thinks it's best to adopt the modification for clarity. We would agree. The modification is consistent with our goal to alleviate the detrimental effect that the DMCA is having on documentary filmmakers' inability to make fair use. And yes, we only want to use it in the documentary that we're making. We don't have all these other things in mind or some kind of slippery slope. So that's not a problem for us. We don't see any real harm to copyright holders, and that's important to us because we are copyright holders. We have 40 years of material that we own the copyright to. We distribute and sell our DVDs. Some have CSS encryption, which is put on by our subcontractors. We understand concerns about copyright infringement in the digital age. We think there is really little threat to the value of CSS because our proposed exemption is narrow. It applies only to fair use and to use of public domain works. The uses are well established and permitted. It does not apply and could be very and cannot be used for infringement by consumers watching a movie in their basement or, you know, that kind of thing, so for just watching something they didn't buy. It would apply only to established documentary filmmakers community. The potential risk that some filmmaker would circumvent CSS based on their own erroneous determination of fair use is small and growing smaller. The only potential risk presented by the this is the only potential risk presented by the exemption, and it applies to the established documentary filmmaking community, which is professional, thoughtful, and responsible about fair use. That's why we came together to come up with the Documentary Filmmaker Statement of Best Practices in Fair Use, with guidelines and drafting help from the Center for Social Media and the Washington College of Law at American University and legal scholars from across the country. So we put a lot of effort into kind of looking at the law, say, well, what does the law mean for us? And now we take this best practice thing and we speak with it all over the country. Just this year, just since the new year began, I've made 6 presentations on this. To different groups of filmmakers. We're also taking it to lawyers and to universities where people are teaching films because there was a lot of misconception about what fair use is and what fair use isn't. And we want people to have a sense of how it is, you know, the sort of confines within which it should be used. This statement outlines what we consider to be responsible fair use practices. The other thing that has happened is, and I couldn't say this a few years ago, but because of the publication of the statement, because of the work that we have done, now the broadcasters are accepting our fair use claims, and we are able to get E&O insurance, which is extremely important because the broadcasters demand it. And we're getting E&O insurance for our fair use claims. And we have to get that insurance. We have to go to an IP lawyer and get a letter. They review our fair use claims. We send them all the clips. We send them, you know, the log. They look at it, and they give us a letter putting in kind of legal language for the insurance companies why this is a legitimate claim. Copyright holders still retain their full rights and remedies for copyright infringement, but without the exemption, documentary filmmakers will continue to bear the unreasonable burden in making fair use in public domain. This burden is real and substantial. I certainly, if someone was stealing our work and infringing on our copyright, I would go over after them, and I have other recourses for that, which I would use. It is my understanding that it is legal to access public domain materials on DVD if that is all that is on the DVD. But today, this is about the whole question of public domain, but today it is almost all public domain material on DVD is bundled with copyrighted material. A silent film in the public domain may be paired with a newer copyrighted soundtrack on the DVD or the DVD. Or another film in the public domain may be bundled with specific features such as mini documentaries or the making of film, that kind of thing. It is far from clear whether it's legal to access the public domain material in these cases. The reply comments seem to ignore this. Public domain works are critical for many important historical documentaries. Without the exemption, some other guidance from the copyright office, we are unable to access increasingly large amounts of public domain materials. So, you know, in conclusion, I would just say that I think this is really it's an important issue to us. We're not asking for any kind of broad and vague and, you know, unfocused exemption. We just want it It, very much like fair use itself, the part of the fair use law that one of the lawyers read to me, because there's all this question about how much can you use, people talk about the 30-second rule, and he read me the part of the law that, kind of says, you can use as much as you need and no more. And I think that's all we're asking for here. We're not asking for more than we need. We're just asking for the minimum that we need and no more. And we're not trying to open up some barn door to people random piracy or anything like that. And because we are a very defined class of people who have put, as a group of people, spent a lot of time and effort in the last 5 years or so getting educated about what fair use is, I think it's a fairly legitimate claim. So that's my testimony. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Jim Morissette.
Okay. Change the technology here. Good morning. My name is Jim Morissette. Good morning. Jim Morissette. I'm the technical director of Cartemquin Films. I've been working for Cartemquin for the last 30 years. Gordon and I have worked on many, many productions, and almost all of them have come to me to be fixed at some point or another. I'd like to talk to you today and sort of explain how we deal with the analog alternatives to CSS encryption and the problems that arise from that, specifically problems that affect our ability to get our shows on public television. It's been suggested that documentary filmmakers like us could use VHS tapes because they do not have CSS encryption, and we indeed have used VHS tapes. And I think, though, that it's pretty universally accepted that VHS image quality, even on a brand new VHS tape, is vastly inferior to DVD to begin with. But the problem doesn't stop there. The problem that we're coming up against right now is availability. It was mentioned by several people yesterday that VHS tapes from distributors are no longer being made. In fact, they stopped. The last distributor ended it last year in 2008 in October. So newer material, television shows and new movies that have come out, are not even available on VHS. But some of the older ones possibly still are. And for our movie on stem cell research, which was broadcast in January of this year, we wanted to include a fair use clip from the Woody Allen movie Sleeper. And we said, well, we can't break the encryption, so let's see if we can find a VHS copy. We couldn't find a VHS copy. We sent interns out to all the local small libraries in the Chicago area, and they finally found a copy at a suburban library that had not thrown out their VHS tapes yet. And so we used that tape as our source for that clip. And this is what we had to do to get it into our program. Push the forward key? Yeah. Forward arrow.
Okay.
These are the steps necessary to get a VHS tape into a program acceptable for broadcast television. You play the VHS tape on a VCR. You have to run it through a time-based corrector in order to remove the analog Macrovision copy control, and then it must be recorded onto a digital form, a digital tape, which is then transferred into the computer and created a file for editing purposes. And as you can see from the chart, especially the red boxes indicate problem areas, problems with the source material, with the Macrovision, problems running through the time-based corrector, because the time-based corrector essentially has to convert that analog signal into a digital signal and then back to an analog signal after the Macrovision is removed. The signal is then recorded on a digital VCR, which again turns analog into digital before we have a tape that we can use. And in all of these steps, we have issues with the brightness, the black level, and most importantly on VHS, there's something called head switch, which is a couple of lines of noise at the bottom of every single VHS tape. It's part of the format. And consumers don't usually see it because their televisions don't show the very last line or two. But broadcasters see it. And that's an important distinction that I will make throughout my presentation, is that there's sort of two kinds of quality. There's the image quality. Is it in focus? Is the black and white contrast viewable? But there's also all these additional hidden signals, the sync signal, the blanking signal, the color burst signal, all of these things which broadcasters insist must be within a very narrow spec. In fact, the FCC insists that they be within a very narrow spec. And if we send one of our programs to public television for broadcast and any of these clips are not within spec, the problem comes back to us to fix, and it is not easy. So what do we do? Well, let's explore a couple of other alternatives to VHS. One alternative that was mentioned and actually presented yesterday is an alternative called scan conversion. Next slide, please. Scan conversion, really, there's three ways to do it, and the way that was shown yesterday is by using a camcorder. This is the exact same setup that was used in the 1950s called kinescope in order to record live television before videotape was invented, basically aiming a camera at a TV screen that's playing whatever material you want to play. However, the steps necessary here raise even more issues that have to be dealt with, both in the transfer, in the setup, and in the post-production part of it. Shooting a TV with a camcorder, as you saw in the clip yesterday, for those of you who are here, involves darkening a room, setting up the camera, dealing with audio connection issues, which are a problem with consumer camcorders because they're expecting a mic level signal as opposed to the line or higher level signal from the DVD player, which causes distortion. And the framing is critical. If you aim at a TV set and it's a little too wide a shot, you're going to get parts of the TV set in the picture. If you zoom in to avoid that, you start cropping off part of the image of your source material, and you start degrading the picture as you magnify it. But there were more serious confusion and technical issues that I saw in the demonstration yesterday. In the demonstration yesterday, a high-definition camera was used to shoot a TV screen. All high-definition cameras are widescreen, 16 by 9, unlike the square 4 by 3 standard def image. If that camcorder had been a standard definition camcorder, it might have only been capable of shooting a square screen. Well, what do you do if you have a wide source picture and a square screen? You end up having black bars on the top and bottom, which, of course, degrades the image even further because only about 40% of the picture is turned over to black bars. What concerned me about the demonstration yesterday was that the source material chosen was a very dark, fast-moving, quick-cutting Harry Potter clip. And it was impossible for me to tell whether or not the frame image off the camcorder was jerky, whether it was flickering, whether the colors were true. If they had chosen something more normal that we would use, for example, presidential speech or something that was on DVD where we could actually see a human face and judge the color, it would have been more easy to compare. But most seriously yesterday was the fact that we did not get the camcorder footage compared directly to a DVD. I'm not sure why they couldn't have just put the DVD in and shown it to us. What they used instead was a downloaded QuickTime compressed file, which of course didn't look any better than shooting off the screen. And I'm not convinced at all that any of that material would pass the public television standards. So I was very disappointed. The other thing that they failed to mention is that once it's on the camcorder, you're not done. You still have to download that footage into a computer. And if it's high definition and you're making a DVD for presentation or inclusion in a standard def program, you have to down-convert that high definition. That's another step before it's able to be used appropriately. So, you know, I'm still not convinced that this is at all an alternative to our problem here. Another method, which is a little more sophisticated in this day and age, is to not use a camera at all, but to use a black box, a piece of hardware, that actually records whatever is on a computer screen. And these kind of literally called scan conversion boxes, are often used for people that are making training videos that want to show the cursor and the movement of, you know, of how computer software works. But it can be used to capture images off the screen. So you play your DVD on the computer, capture it with this hardware box, and so hopefully output a video signal that you can then record. The problem is computers don't play video the same way that television plays video. Computers play video in a progressive mode. But public television and all the broadcasters want a final product that's an interlaced mode, which is what's coming out of the DVD if you play it on a DVD player. So there's this change from progressive to interlaced and back to progressive, which leads to a vast amount of image loss in terms of image resolution, which is literally cut in half. There's also a synchronous problem with the audio because there's a significant delay coming out of the scan converter box. It can be as much as half a second. And the audio does not go through this box, only the picture. So you end up with an out-of-sync product that you then have to resync in the editing room. It's doable, but it takes time and effort. A third method, Gordon, please, thank you, of scan conversion is using actual software. No black box required. Just go out and buy a $100 piece of software, and it will record anything that happens on your computer screen. Well, I've tested some of these. Some that have been mentioned yesterday were Snagit, and we've tried Jing Pro and several others. And while they may be acceptable for producing web clips, low-resolution web clips, they don't do a very good job. In fact, they do an unacceptable job for our use. Why? Because they don't have the ability to capture the full frame rate of the DVD playback. DVDs play back at 30 frames a second. And these software programs, even on a quad-core Intel Mac, are lucky if they reach 15 frames per second. So when you play them back, you get jerky motion. And the other problem is it's very difficult with these software programs to define a precise part of the picture to record. You obviously don't want to record the player window and the toolbar at the top and the cursor. You want to just record where the movie is playing. And if you get it wrong, your file has to be blown up or cropped or something, manipulated, in order to get the proper frame size for the program that you're editing. There's only three frame sizes allowed for broadcast, and if you're off, you're in trouble. If the picture's too small, you have black lines around it, that's not acceptable. If you zoom in on the picture to cover up all the black lines, you lose image area, and you also degrade, again, the visual quality of the image. So this is no good either. So what do we do now? Well, let's go to the next step, and this is the step that we have used that we are using up to this point, which is called the DVD analog transfer method, often nicknamed the analog hole. And this process is very similar to our VHS process that we used in the past, whereas we play a DVD, an encrypted DVD, on a standard DVD player. And again, the DVDs, I don't know if everybody knows this, but the DVD players also have a Macrovision analog copy control still, so that the analog output of the DVD player is not directly recordable to a VCR. You have to still run it through an expensive time-based corrector to strip that off. But then you simply record it on a digital VCR and use that as your new source for your program. The problem with this method is severalfold. One is you're starting with an analog signal out of the DVD player. And if anybody's ever connected a DVD player to their new plasma screen via analog composite signal and compared that with the digital signal, it's like night and day. The composite signal is blurry, the colors are washed out, it's just a mediocre signal. There's also an issue with black level, and the only reason I raise this is because it affects not only the look of the image but also whether or not public television will accept it. All analog signals have a black level that's higher than digital signals. And because of that, you have to modify the black level coming out of the DVD player And that can be done in various places, but you have to do it carefully so that you don't degrade the actual visual image quality any more than necessary. But I'm sure you've all seen on TV shows a lot, all of a sudden they'll cut to a shot and it looks all washed out. It's kind of gray instead of having richness to it. That's because it came from an analog source and it wasn't processed properly. So these are issues that affect our ability to use this material in a way without having to lose image quality and continue to do this high level of processing. What we do as a standard workflow is that even with all of my expertise and the equipment that we have at Kartemkin, we still have to send our programs out to a high-tech gatekeeper. And we send them to Pillar to Post, which is in Arlington, Virginia. And they are one of the approved public television quality control houses. And they run our show through their system, and they send us back a computer readout, which if it's 5 pages, we feel fortunate. Sometimes it's more. And say, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. And this shot, you got to replace this shot. It's technically not the right signal. The frame is too small, too big, too much blanking, colors, whatever. And these are things that are grounds for rejection from broadcasts. And so either we try to fix them or we have Pillar to Post fix them in some cases, which we did with New Americans. And, of course, this adds an additional burden in time and money. I think it's a key point here, though, that it's not just that we need something that's, quote, good enough. If we were showing a clip in a classroom, you know, some of these other methods possibly would be good enough, even though there's still a heck of a lot of trouble and time and effort. You're not going to have somebody in a classroom say, oh, well, the blanking was off or your black levels were wrong. But for broadcast, the buck stops there. And if we want to just be able to distribute our films on national television and broadcast, and it's not just the broadcasters. Many of the cable stations like Discovery and History Channel are equally picky about maintaining standards. And when these analog conversions come into the show, they stand out as being visually and aesthetically, ooh, you know, where did that come from kind of thing, to being outright kicked out and have to be replaced by something that's technically better. A lot of filmmakers don't have the option to do this. They can't afford it. And so they just give up and don't use the material. If we get this exemption, we'll be able to extract digital files that are the right aspect ratio, the right frame size, the right frame rate, the right black level. Everything will be correct, and it's just a matter of cutting them into our show. I think it's critical to mention again, I was going to start with this, but I'm going to mention it again, that when we make fair use of a clip in our documentaries, we only need these short clips, less than a minute each. We never convert more than that. It's not like there's a copy, a de-encrypted copy of the movie sitting on a hard drive somewhere at Kartemkin that an intern could take home. We only capture the short clips that we need, and only those are ever converted to editable computer files for our show. So it's not like we're just ripping everything as it comes in the door thinking we might need it someday. It's a lot of work to copy these things over, and we only use the small clips that we feel are definitely fair use material. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I think that's it for the proponents of this particular exemption, correct? Then we're going to move to the other side and first go to Bruce Turnbull. Congratulations on moving up to the front row, Bruce.
Thank you. Well, as you know, but for the record, I am Bruce Turnbull of the law firm Weil, Gotchel & Manges, LLP. I'm pleased to be here today representing the DVD Copy Control Association. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to present our views on the issues this morning. I won't repeat my comments from yesterday, but would ask that you keep them in mind, particularly with regard to the standard for class of works. As I stated yesterday, but I really want to emphasize that again this morning, DVD-CCA's primary concern is the viability of its technology. Well, obviously, our technology is used to protect the movies and the other audio-video material. In this context, we are the proprietor of the technology that's at issue here. CSS enabled the development of the DVD market and is still critical to its commercial viability. Section 1201 was enacted, in fact, with CSS as the example of a technological protection measure that was in use at the time. CSS was introduced in 1997 in the United States. The DMCA was enacted in 1998 with full knowledge and understanding that this was the premier technological protection measure that was available at the time. And so the provisions of 1201 actually were, I mean, the members of Congress understood how they would work in relation to CSS. And so we think it's very important that the protections of 1201 remain with regard to the viability of the technology. Now, specifically with regard to the documentary filmmaking comments, first of all, we see these as being in a different category because they are commercial in nature and not in relation to education, as we discussed at some length yesterday. The 2006 film professor's exemption was deemed by the Copyright Office and the librarian to be necessary for pedagogical purposes, and those were key to the decision at that time. Here we simply don't have that same quality. We just went through. I won't try to match Mr. Morissette on the technology. I will note that he'll be happy to know that almost all DVDs that are being released today do not enable Macrovision. So for the future, all of the circumvention of Macrovision, I'm sure if they were here, they'd have something to say about all of that. But in any event, it won't be necessary for most movies. Not all, but most. The alternatives, understand the limitations of what was presented yesterday by MPAA representative with regard to the camcording. I think the point that was being made, and I think very well made by that, was that the camcorder option has become a viable one in light of the development of technology, both as to the nature of the screens that you're taking the picture of and the type of cameras that are being used. I guess I'm a little hard-pressed to think that the professional filmmakers would actually have the great difficulty that were suggested in terms of sizing the image with their cameras, but I think the image that was presented yesterday and the comparison that was made with what we had available from the film studies professor, who said this is what they wanted to use in their class. And so the comparison, I think, was intended to be a comparison to say, is this good enough for the purpose that the film studies professors were putting forward for their use? And so I think, not quite fair to criticize the comparison that was made. It was made for that purpose. I also think that it's important to emphasize that the documentary filmmakers, everybody has time constraints, but they do not have the same time constraints as the film and media studies professors had put forward in the last round and again yesterday. Part of the basis of the 2006 decision was that the film studies professors were limited to 50-minute class times and couldn't use some of the technologies because of that, and that they're making final revisions to lectures the very night before the lecture is actually delivered. In the filmmaking that we're talking about here, they're talking about a relatively lengthy process, and the filmmakers have time to take the steps to undertake some of the alternatives that the film studies professors felt were not viable given the time constraints. I will also say and reiterate specifically in this regard, in each of the rulemaking contexts, 2000, 2003, 2006, and again this time, DVD-CCA has said we welcome people to come talk to us about their specific needs and concerns. No one has ever done so. And I think that we would be far better off if the marketplace could work this out through specific arrangements that might be made with DVD-CCA as the proprietor of CSS, rather than having sort of public permission for circumventing the technological protection measure that was one of the things that Congress intended to present. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I guess I'll save my remarks on the other exemption for when we get to that one.
Yes, please. Steve Vitalis.
Thank you. It's good to be back here again this morning. For the record, this is Steve Vitalis from Mitchell, Silverberg, and Knupp, representing nine copyright owner and creator organizations in this proceeding. And I appreciate the chance to respond to the presentation regarding a proposed exemption 11B. I think it's clear that this the proponents of this exemption have made a good effort to try to bring their proposal within the existing framework that the Copyright Office has been using and that Congress set forth, and that stands in contrast to 11A, which I thought until we sat down this morning we would be talking about first. But I think they've definitely tried to avoid some of those flaws, but I think there are still some of the same problems that we also see with the other proposal. Let me start by talking about non-infringing use, then about alternatives, and then about narrowing any proposed exemption in this area. It's clear that what the office needs to be deciding here is whether the prohibition on circumvention of access controls substantially impedes a use that is in fact non-infringing. That's the standard that the office has used consistently throughout the proceeding, the history of the proceeding. Sometimes they say generally non-infringing. I think we've collected the citations in section two of our submission, but it's got to be something that the use that is enabled has to be something that you could be quite confident that you can say is non-infringing. Now, is that the case with the use of clips in documentary films? Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And again, on page 68 of our submission, we do make reference to the Presley case, and it's not the only case, but there certainly are instances in which documentaries were made using clips that were found not to be fair use or were found to exceed the scope of fair use. Now, I'm not suggesting that anything that Cartemquin has done falls into that category, but the point is that the office is not in a position to, under the law, is not in a position to recommend an exemption unless it can determine that the use that's enabled by circumvention is in fact non-infringing. And I also think it's fair to say that this is inherently more difficult when the basis for the claim of non-infringement is fair use, Section 107, because that's inherently a case-by-case determination, as we all know. And it's a little different when you're relying on one of the other statutory exemptions or when permission is involved. But that kind of comes with the territory. I think that is a burden that the proponent has to meet. They attempt to meet that in this case by using a couple of proxies. It only applies to a documentary filmmaker who is a member of an organization of filmmakers or is enrolled in a film program or film production course at a post-secondary educational institution. And I think the intent is to up the chances, increase the chances that the resulting use is going to be fair, is going to be a fair use under the law. And I think Mr. Quinn said the risk is small and getting smaller because of the activities of some of the organizations that that he is involved with. Well, I think this is a good effort to try to come up with a proxy for getting to the meeting the test of, in fact, non-infringing. I would have to question whether it succeeds and how much or how exactly being a member of a particular organization increases the likelihood that the use you would be making would be non-infringing. I think there's something of a disconnect there, and even documentary filmmakers have pointed this out. If you look at the reply comments of Vamp Production, they question why this should be, why there's necessarily any connection between the likelihood of non-infringement and membership in an organization. As far as enrolling in a film program or film production course, again, that is not clear to me what the connection is that would lower the risk that this would be non-infringing. We heard yesterday from Professor DeCherney that in many of the film programs that he's involved with, students apparently never touch a camera or do anything having to do with production. We don't know to what extent they're taught about fair use in these in those types of classes. So I would suggest that being enrolled in a film program or film production course at a post-secondary educational institution would have a very tenuous link, if any, with the likelihood that your use would be non-infringing. So this, I think, is the first the first big hurdle that this proposal attempts to surmount, but I would question whether it does so, and that's the question of whether the use will be in fact non-infringing. Now, then let's turn to the question of alternatives. There has been a lot of good discussion about this already. There are really three that I'd like to talk just briefly about. One is licensing or non-objection, a consensual path. The second is the scan conversion that was talked about, camcording. And the third is the use of other digital formats. On the first point, I think it is important to clear up that there may be some confusion here between two concepts. One is fair use and the other is non-infringing use. They're not identical. One subsumes the other. Fair use does not require permission, but a use that is permitted is a non-infringing use. And if the office finds that people who wish to circumvent can make a non-infringing use by getting permission to make it, then the test of the statute is certainly satisfied. That's a non-infringing use. I think Mr. Quinn really gave two reasons why he objected to this, and the second one really is that I shouldn't have to ask for permission in order to make fair use, and that's absolutely right. But you can certainly make fair use without obtaining these clips. And I guess this is the point at which, since Fritz Attaway is not here, I will refer to the decision of the Corley decision in the Second Circuit. Fair use has never been held to be a guarantee of access to copyrighted material in order to copy it by the fair user's preferred techniques or in the format of the original. That conclusion, of course, has been echoed by the office in many of the prior proceedings. So you certainly don't need permission to make fair use, but you also don't need to circumvent in order to make fair use. There is information in the record about the licensing situation. I'd call your attention to the comments of Time Warner, and I believe it's 368 instances last year in which they granted permission or expressed non-objection to filmmakers involved in documentary projects. So the picture isn't certainly quite as bleak as it might be presented from the perspective of the proponents. And the discussion of lab fees, I mean, if lab fees is the cost that you incur to get a higher quality clip, it's hard to see that it constitutes an impediment flowing from the prohibition that is impeding non-infringing use, even assuming you can show non-infringing use. Lab fees are sometimes charged, certainly, by the studios. I think that the Time Warner submission discusses that. But it doesn't seem to me that would constitute a basis for circumvention under the statute. Then on the scan conversion, and I think the charts that, Mr. Morissette presented were very interesting and helpful, and we will take a look at those. The proponents saw fit not to present those in either of the two previous rounds, but to bring them to this hearing where we're seeing them for the first time today. But we'll be interested to take a look at that and have some of the technical experts, which I'm certainly not, give some reactions to that. And the only point I would make, I think Bruce has already talked about the camcording demonstration from yesterday, and I would encourage the office to compare apples with apples here. When we got a disc from the Copyright Office, maybe it turned out to be a pomegranate, so we did the best we could. But I hope you could make that type of comparison with the material that you have in the record. The final point I'd like to make about alternatives is that I think the submissions overlook the fact that there are an increasing number of digital formats that aren't protected by access controls that are being used to distribute at least some of the material, I'm not saying all the material, that that the proponents are interested in excerpting. The submission says that the DVD format is becoming more and more dominant as the means for distributing digital audiovisual products. I would have agreed with that up until a year or two ago, but I think in the day and age of Hulu.com and all of the network sites that are providing a lot of video material in digital format, much of it in the clear, not all of it in the clear, I think there are going to be other digital formats that will be accessible without circumvention, and that hasn't been even mentioned by the proponents, and it certainly is part of the overall environment here. So let me turn in conclusion to some of the points about narrowing. If the office concludes that the proponents have demonstrated that their use will in fact be non-infringing, and if they have persuaded you that none of the alternative means that either they have talked about or that we talked about and they didn't talk about, such as other digital formats, if you're persuaded that none of those is sufficient, then I think we turn to phrasing of any exemption that would be recognized. And I had 8 or 9 points here, but maybe there may be one or two of them that have already been dealt with. I mean, first of all, just in terms of the phrasing of the exemption, we don't think it's appropriate to refer to public domain material because no exemption is needed there. The precedent of this proceeding is clear on that. We also don't believe it's wise to make the reference to fair use or Section 107. And I think we'll be talking about this later this morning, but I think if that becomes an element of these exemptions, we're far down the road to saying whatever you do, so long as it results in a non-infringing use, is okay. And I think Congress made it clear that was not the law, and that's not within the purview of what they expected or would allow this proceeding to end up with. We do think it's important to stress that any exemption should be applied only when necessary, and we do think it would be a good idea in this context, if there is to be an exemption, to require some documentation of a good faith effort to obtain the material without circumvention. As we've said, there are many alternatives, and if in fact the office finds that it is persuaded that those taken together won't cover the field, then I'm not sure what the objection would be to requiring that good faith effort and documentation of that good faith effort. We also suggested that perhaps there should be some notice of use or some record developed about the circumstances in which there is circumvention here. And that would certainly be useful if an exemption is granted in terms of looking 3 years down the road as to how it was used. So we would encourage you to consider that. I think the Soli issue has already been addressed, and we appreciate the proponents' agreement on that. Soli for this purpose, I was a little puzzled to hear that circumvention could be accomplished in a way, at least I thought I heard, that circumvention could be accomplished in a way that only the clip of less than a minute would be in the clear. I'm not quite sure how that works, and I noticed that one of the charts that was not shown here was how the circumvention exemption would operate, which boxes you would go through if you had the circumvention exemption, but perhaps that could be spelled out later. We certainly would suggest that the language that you have used in the e-book exemption be applied to any exemption in this field that requires that the conditions the applicability of the exemption on a showing that all the existing digital editions are protected by CSS. As we've said, there are increasingly digital formats that are available that aren't protected for much of this material. I certainly don't say for all of this material. And finally, two, which really are just drafting suggestions. One, I don't think it actually clearly states that this exemption is limited to DVDs protected by CSS. I think that's the intent of the proponents. And finally, any exemption should clearly spell out who it is that can exercise this exemption. So these are sort of the more general suggestions we have had for how the office should approach these exemptions that increasingly, and to somewhat distressingly, are defined in terms of the characteristics of the use and the user. I share the concern that Bruce Turnbull has stated for the record, and I'll state it for the record as well, as far as that trend in the in this proceeding. But I think some of the safeguards that we've talked about here that could be applicable to any exemption in this area would probably help in terms of minimizing the risks there. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions and either now or later.
Steve, I did want to ask about just because that wasn't clear. I wasn't clear what I was hearing. And that last in your list of your litany of kinds of conditions you'd like to put on it, what I wrote down was you said clarify who can exercise the exemption. Is that what you said, or if not, what did you say? And could you expand on what you meant by that?
Yes, the exemption is kind of drafted in a passive voice. It's motion pictures with certain characteristics when a documentary filmmaker is accessing material. So. Is the documentary filmmaker the person that can circumvent? That's really my question. Or is it the documentary filmmaker, his agents, his who is it that can do this? So that's okay. Just to be clear.
So it sounds like a drafting issue, really.
I think so. I think Okay. Those last two were pretty much drafting issues.
Okay. The plan was to go directly to the reigning witnesses on the next issue, but I think it might make sense to spend 10 or 15 minutes at least asking some questions while we've got these issues in our mind. I'm not saying we're going to ask all the questions we have on that because we need to make sure we get everyone in, but I do think it probably would be helpful for us to at least ask some questions that now that we have them, now that you're here. I don't know. Do you want to start, Rob? Or? Okay. Well, let's start with what Steve just was talking about, and these will be questions depending on the particular issue that I'll be asking to both of you, perhaps. I just want to sort of get primarily the reaction of the proponents of this exemption to some of those conditions that Steve was talking about. In some cases, I may want some reactions from Steve, too. Let's start with what I have down as the first thing you mentioned. There's no need to mention public domain material. There's no exemption needed there because Section 1201 doesn't cover public domain material. I actually think I heard you respond to that in your main case, but just in any event, I'd like to hear your position on that, and then Steve may have a response.
Yeah, I was a little confused by that, but the point that we're trying to make is that you have a DVD. It has stuff on it that's in the public domain, but it's bundled with, and the whole thing is encrypted with all kinds of other material. Mm-hmm. So to get to the thing that is public domain, you then have to break the encryption. And that's sort of becoming more and more common. I also just want to comment on this idea that there's all these new sources of things. And remember, we're talking about broadcast standard here. We're still talking about broadcast. So a lot of these things that are on the internet, and other kind of things are very, very problematic for us. Some of them we're looking into and that kind of thing, but, you know, they're not necessarily there. I did want to respond to the one thing you said about, how is this class of people going to know? And you mentioned the Presley case. And just to reassure you, that's something that when I speak on this matter, and there are many other people who, the Center for Social Media, there's a whole group of us and these organizations that are trying to really make our field aware of both what fair use is and its limitations. And we refer to that Presley case all the time and, you know, present it to a group of filmmakers who would feel, you know, if someone did that to them, they'd feel ripped off. So we're saying, now this is what it's, this is, you know, this is an extreme case, but it's certainly not that. So we're very concerned about this question of, you know, where do you draw the line and that kind of thing. And the process that went into creating this document was to bring people together from our field all across the country. We hosted meetings in Chicago and there were a lot in other cities with lawyers and with people from the Center for Social Media, and we would have this dialogue about, you know, how do we interpret the law and where do we see it, and I, you know, and we found there was a point where people said, well, wait a minute, you know, that's we don't want to go there, you know, that's going too far. So this is what we are, we've done a lot of work in this area, and in terms of the schools and the universities, this year alone, I've been to several schools. The last one was the University, Michigan State University at Lansing, where I spoke on this issue to documentary filmmaker students. So rest assured that this is rather a robust, we see this as an important part of, in a sense, reclaiming our fair use rights, because people really need to know what those rights are, and they also need to know what the limitations are and what's in the law. So, you know, we put a lot of effort into that.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
Just in terms of the public domain works, that what can you give us just some idea of what kind of material, public domain material, you would need to get from a protected DVD? Like, for instance, I'm just, what's coming to mind is something like newsreels or things that come up. And so in, is it just a matter of, why would you need to get that from a DVD as opposed to maybe going back to source material?
You might not. For certain old feature films, they may not be, you know, things that are in the public domain, things from the silent era, might not be available in any other format. We often do, you know, we often will go back to source material if you can get your hands on it. Another kind of example are things that are in the public domain. Really the only thing, because it's not a big element for our kinds of documentaries, it's more the historical documentaries where this is a big issue. But the one time that I did have experience with this was where I got, this was before CSS encryption, but we made a film called the Chicago Maternity Center film. We used footage from Prayer Lorenz's Fight for Life. The film was a government film, and it was in the public domain. And, you know, it was a public domain use. I'm not sure if I could get it today. I could look into that and get back to you. But I know that a lot of stuff that other filmmakers use from the early days of film, from things that are in the public domain, from old news footage and stuff like that. Some of it is available and some of it isn't. Some of it is, you know, bundled on these, you know, these DVDs where someone has re-released it. You know, this is actually a fairly common thing where people take something that they don't actually own, but it's not clear who does own it. They package it with new material and put a copyright on it and say, now, you know, we own it. And in fact, the underlying piece they don't own. They underline the new material, the new soundtrack, whatever it is.
Okay, so, Steve, let's get your response to that public domain issue, the notion of public domain material being bundled with copyright material and therefore protected by CSS.
Yeah, certainly that occurs, and my recollection is that this was an issue in the 2003 proceeding and certainly didn't result in an exemption, but I'd have to go back and look at the analysis for it. We quoted in our submission, I think, the conclusion about public domain material, and I think it remains the case that circumventing access control that's been placed on public domain material is not a violation of the statute, so no exemption is needed. But I guess I would like to reserve, I'd like to go back and see what it was that the office said about that specifically in 2003.
I think the way that we see the problem is, we need the exemption because even though it's in the public domain, if you break the encryption,